This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security. This is the 106th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have today with me Steve Katz. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Gary. Good morning. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good. It's, you know, it's less snowy down here than it is up there, I bet.
We are at a warm, sunny 23 degrees.
Steve Katz is a consultant for Security Risk Solutions, which he founded and runs. He's regarded as the world's first CISO. Katz served as a senior security executive for Citibank, Citigroup, JP Morgan, Merrill Lynch, and Kaiser Permanente. Steve also serves on multiple advisory boards, like 100 jillion of them, including one for CSG and Vodus, which I serve on as well. He founded the FSISAC with a bunch of others, and he continues to advise that esteemed body, and he lives in New York City. So thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Gary.
So we all want to know, especially us geeks that are sort of down in the trenches a little bit, what does a CSO do all day, and what are the sort of main three job duties of CSO?
It is an interesting history of how the position evolved. In the mid-90s, Citicorp was hacked by a group out of Russia, and the search team went out to find somebody who was going to be an information security executive who would be reporting to the risk committee / audit committee of the board, a direct line into the CTO, and two down from the CEO.
So really first seat at the table for security.
First executive seat, highly visible, two-edged sword. The position was the result of Citi being astute enough to do an in-depth assessment of why the hack took place, what happened, what needed to happen, and how Citi could get its message across. The system that was hacked was the development system for the International Funds Transfer System.
Wow.
And when the folks broke in, Citi at the time, and against many others, production data was used in the development data center as well as production IDs and passwords.
For testing purposes. Yeah, I remember as a result of that hack, we actually had to do a bunch of work at FINRA, which was NASD at the time, to switch their testing system so they didn't use production data.
And that was a big step, and FINRA did the right thing, and Citi, once the hack was identified, did the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
The concern that the CEO had, and this certainly rose to the level of the board, was to figure out what happened and put in a process program to make sure, A, it didn't happen again, but also do whatever was necessary to limit the impact on the bank in terms of losing key customers, right?
Right. So that's kind of the story of how that particular CSO role developed. I'm wondering, what does a CSO today do? Like, what are the top three jobs?
Exactly. And the first one, and this is sort of how the whole thing came about, was you become the chief executive officer and chief marketing officer of a company called Information Security or Information Risk or technology risk.
Aha, inside of your organization.
Inside, exactly.
Yeah.
And it is getting the message out to the business executives, business leadership, and the C-suite as to what the program is doing, why it's doing it, where it's doing it, what exposure still exists, and what has to take place. And it's not a once-a-year effort. It is getting out to business executives across the company, and with Citi it was geographic, but across geography as well. But it is a matter of getting out and meeting with business executives 2 to 3 times a year so that they understand why something's being done and why it's needed, why their cooperation is needed, and why it is important to the business that these people are running.
So it's kind of like air support, really, flying air cover for the information security organization.
Great analogy, because that's exactly what it is.
Yep.
It says, so this way, when there is an issue, and there will be issues, and you have to call the executive, this isn't the first time he or she has met you.
Right.
And they're willing to understand and listen to you and to understand why it happened, what was going on, what was exposed, and more importantly, what do we need to do to, A, correct it, and B, prevent it from happening again.
So do you have any tips for interacting with the board or the CEO as a CISO?
I think the most important job the CISO has today, and the most successful ones do this very well, is getting out and first understanding the business that your company is in.
Mm-hmm.
What are the products? What are the services? What are the benefits? Who are the customers? Who makes the decisions? What products are being developed going forward? So you have a firm understanding of what your company really does and why what you are doing is important to your company. So the role is trying to understand what is the, at all times, what is the business risk that you are dealing with? Message I tried to get across, and I think it's incredibly important today, is business, technology doesn't have risk. CISOs don't have risk. Businesses have risk.
Right.
And it's getting the businesses to understand that here is a risk or concern as I understand it.
So I want to push on that a little bit. There are a lot of security types, not as senior as you, I will admit, who collect lots of metrics and they collect key performance indicators or KPIs. And I think it might be helpful to explain what's the difference between a KPI and a key risk indicator. I think you already said it, but let's just underline that.
I mean, a KPI is describing what you are doing and how you are meeting service level agreements. They are operational indicators. The risk indicator says, is there a potential exposure to the company or the business? Does the indicator highlight an area that you should be concerned with? In some cases, it could be vulnerabilities that need to be addressed. In other cases, it can be audit exceptions that have to be addressed, or examiner exceptions that have to be addressed that pose a risk to the company. In other cases, it could be, and the key role for the CISO is to put together a security assessment team, not an audit team, but a team that goes out and analyzes what is happening in a particular line of business and in particular products, services, and technology that support that line of business, and then go back and meet with the business executive where there's a report that goes only to the business executive. It is not an audit report. It is not an examiner report. It is something that says, here is what we see, and here are the exposures we see that you have to deal with, and here's how we recommend you deal with them.
So how do you measure risk? I mean, it sounds like it's something that needs to be done on a business unit by business unit basis to some extent.
I've tried to keep it as simple as possible, and I've also been accused of being way overly simplistic.
I think that's actually really good praise when that happens.
I don't mean this to insult anybody. I find that senior executives, business executives, C-suites are very good with primary colors and single-digit numbers. So I try to talk to them in terms of when we are looking at risk, we are looking at a compass, not a watch.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to give you a directional indicator, not precision.
Right.
So it is, how do I see the risk of A versus B versus C versus D?
Yeah, so let's kind of put a fine point on it. I mean, some people will say, I'm going to tell you the number of times that our firewall turned away bad packets, blah, blah, blah. And no senior executive cares about that. What they care about is, what's the remaining risk, even if that process it's doing its own thing? So there are all these numbers that float around that are utterly meaningless at the senior level.
I had, apropos of that, I had dinner with a CEO of a very large firm a while back, and he had just, his last meeting of the day, and it was a two-hour meeting, was with his CISO.
Mm-hmm.
And he walked in and sitting over a glass of wine, he said, "I don't understand." I said, "I really don't understand. I just spent 2 hours with my CISO." He walked in with 45 pages of numbers, arrows, charts. And I, at the end of it, I didn't understand what he, what his concerns were, why he was telling me, you know, whether he was telling me something that was important or not. Did he want me to act on it?
Was there an ask, you know, you ask the classic senior executive stuff, like, what do you want here?
And the message, I mean, the person, the CISO was absolutely right with everything he brought to the table, but so what?
Right.
And which, the term I've used throughout my career is used to drive my my staff crazy and drive potential vendors crazy, is they'd walk into my office and say, "We have, this is going on." And I would say, "Okay, so what?"
Exactly. And there better be an answer, huh?
If there's no so what, why are you bothering me?
Yeah.
If you want me to do something, why is this important?
Right. So I guess that's the number one role is air support and translation to business speak.
Mm-hmm. And it's, what is meaningful to the people you're going to speak with?
Yeah.
And if it's not meaningful to them, and you do this two or three times, you walk by, you know, you walk in and say, "Oh my, okay, now what are you going to bore me with?" Although they may not be quite that overt about it.
I don't know. Sometimes in New York they are. So,
In New York it would be, get to the point or get out.
Right. So I want to ask you kind of a toughie. In your career as a CSO, what was the biggest mistake you made and how did you correct it?
Biggest mistake I made was, and it, I corrected it early. Biggest mistake I made, I had a room full of people there. And in my own head, I said, "Geez, I know more about this than they do."
Mm-hmm.
And the epiphany that I had, and I've heard other, you know, some very senior executives, including Michael Dell, say this: if you ever think you are the smartest person in the room, go to another room.
Right. Plus, you're probably wrong.
I'm definitely wrong. And so what I learned to do early on, this is at J.P. Morgan, but also more so at Citi, I said I only wanted to find people who are a hell of a lot smarter than I was, who knew a lot more about the subject than I did. And it was easier to find people smarter than I am, and it was easier to find people who knew more about the subject.
Mm-hmm. So you build a team of people that are exceptionally great.
And they knew, and when I brought these people on, the challenge was, you know, you are going to be, you know, I want you because you're going to be the best in the field, and I want to make sure that the group we build will be recognized as the best information security group in the field.
So the mistake was what, originally thinking you had to be the smartest guy in the room,
right. Exactly.
And then realizing that actually what you need to do is develop resources that are even better than you are.
And you know, it's also cliche, but if you bring in giants, then you are standing on the shoulder of giants.
So I was going to turn the question around and ask you what the biggest win is, but you can just use the very same answer, which is cheating.
I'll tell you the biggest win, and the biggest win was the win during my first 3 months at Citi. They sent me out to meet with the corporate treasurers of the 20 plus companies, that the 20 plus best corporate banking customers,
mm-hmm.
and sit them down, because the hack hadn't been public at that point.
Right.
Sit them down and say, "This is what happened at Citi," and because it was going to become public.
Right.
And then I put together six or seven non-technical questions. And I said, I'll run through them quickly, but the first question is, and he said fundamental security at the time, do you care about who you're talking to or transacting with?
Mm-hmm.
Do you care about what they're going to do? Do you care about privacy and confidentiality? Do you care about integrity of data? Do you care about receipt, you know, signed receipts for transactions, and do you care about if there's a problem, do you care about how quickly you know about it?
So you were asking those questions of the customers?
No, what I did is said, here are the questions I'm looking at as Citi's new CISO.
Uh-huh.
Here is how Citi is dealing with each of these questions.
Oh, I got it. And so you're kind of leading the speaker in a Socratic form.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And I said, now what I'd like to recommend you do, because, again, the hack will become public. Go out to your other four or five or six banks that you deal with and ask them how they answer those questions.
Right.
And over the course of a couple months after that, what I kept hearing is, they're telling me it's security, they can't make it public, they can't share it.
Right. So you were trying to level the playing field, and I bet, I mean, ultimately you did, I think.
Mm-hmm. We didn't lose the customer.
Uh-huh.
Because candor and honesty worked, and my response back to them is, if they can't share this with you as the customer, then you have to push them to make sure they share this, and then compare the answers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. I have another tricky question for you. So we talked about risk indicators and measuring risk and how that impacts the business, but there's another role for the CSO which is very difficult, and I don't understand how people do that. And it is prioritizing among different program elements, because you have parts of your information security program that have different tempos, they have different impacts, they have timelines that might be utterly different, and you have to sort of figure out how to invest in each of those and which ones to accelerate and which ones to soft pedal. How do you do that?
It almost comes back to the risk management issue. And we looked at any situation, what is the issue or concern we're dealing with, whether it's a threat or a vulnerability? And what I did was, and again, it dealt with relative risk. So vulnerability or a threat, and it's high, medium, low.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Likelihood of occurrence, and I've seen people go way off the deep end on this, is high, medium, or low.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you 100%. The numbers are vacuous nonsense.
Yeah, you multiply two or three decimal positions, and now you're right to six decimal positions.
It's like people never had that scientific numbering class in sixth grade, I guess.
Yeah.
Significant numbers, remember that?
What is the potential impact? High, medium, or low?
Mm-hmm.
And then we're turning around and saying, this one, here are the numbers associated with these four or five or six or ten issues. Here's how they sort of stack out, compare, relative to each other on high, the highest risk down to the lowest risk.
Mm-hmm. And then you sort of use that to drive with.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. And if they came too close, then we would tweak the important component, the most important component, and that is impact.
Right. Yeah, so that's very similar to how the safety people did it with SIL levels and all that stuff. If you look at safety critical situations, did you guys crib off of that, or did you come up with this independently?
We came up with it. I'm not sure. And it came up. We came up with it sitting in a room and saying, okay, what are we really saying?
Uh-huh.
And how do we do this without confusing the hell out of everybody?
Right. Make it simple, but drive in a clear and meaningful mm-hmm. way.
And the other thing, it was kind of interesting, one of the other things that worked out very well, when I got to Citi, and I was there a couple of days, and they said, we have some security standards out there. We're not sure how good they are, but we have something called security variances.
Mm-hmm.
And they walked in, my admin walked in with a stack of about maybe 8 inches high of security variance. And you're responsible for approving these.
Right.
And I said, come out.
No.
I'm making a policy, and we'll get it out to everybody. And I was too dumb to know that you had policy, process of making policies. There's now no policy.
I think policy by caveat's the best way.
And it said, we're going to have a one page, and time, at that time it was paper, a risk, not, it's not a variance, it's a risk acceptance.
And you have to sign it.
You have to sign it, and it was, here's what I don't want to do, here's why I don't want to do it, here's the risk as I understand it.
And I'm accepting that.
And I'm accepting it, and there was one line at the bottom.
Yeah, I bet you got zero of those turned in.
The one line at the bottom made all the difference.
It sure does.
Going ahead with this, moving forward with this, is against the recommendation of the CISO.
Mm-hmm.
Choice of words very carefully. Recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
So the business executive would go ahead and accept the risk, or mm-hmm. not accept the risk.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, I just let it go. It was okay.
Mm-hmm.
In other cases, before it would go through, I would call the business executive and say, you may want to rethink this because moving forward with it, it's against my recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
Two of the metrics I reported up to the risk committee were number of risk acceptances by line of business.
Yep.
And number of risk acceptances by line of business that overruled the recommendation of the CISO.
Do they still use those metrics, do you think?
I would hope so, but I don't know for sure. But interesting enough, there were a number of risk acceptances, and that was fine.
Yeah.
In the 7 years or so, there was never one that went against my recommendation.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so what it is a way of just making the risk transfer exceptionally clear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well said, I didn't do it. I'm making a recommendation. As a CISO, I will make a recommendation. You make the decision.
So,
because I can't assess the direct impact on your business as effectively as you can.
So I want to turn the questions a little bit towards building stuff. In a typical mature information security program, how much resource do you think should be allocated to proactive risk management, like security engineering or software security, the stuff that I like to talk about, versus standard network security and monitoring and response and all that other stuff?
If you can prevent it, you save yourself a whole bunch of hurt. If we sort of look at the wonderful thing we're blessed with called the body,
mm-hmm.
The body spends a lot of its time, or as much as possible, attempting to prevent a problem. And the body is very good, and we wind up getting all kinds of vaccinations. But and we're built with the defense mechanisms, built into the body mm-hmm. to prevent a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, in your case of software security, if you can build secure code, you're keeping stuff out.
Yeah. So how much do you spend relatively on that?
That's where you want to apportion your money more towards the prevention, but with the recognition, as with the body, bad stuff will happen.
Right. Nothing's ever perfect.
So my next step is, I know I can't prevent everything. I know stuff is going to come through. How quickly can I detect a problem? Because detection is probably the thing I wanted to get to closest to prevention.
Right, because you need to know as soon as possible when something's going bad.
Yeah. So, and the more we can compress the time frame between a problem and reaction, the more we're going to limit the impact of that problem.
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, I think that we're still suffering from a little bit of an overemphasis on that as a field, not really in financial sector as much as some other sectors, but the government likes to watch stuff, and they don't spend very much at all on building things properly. But they're really good at watching, and so they can see something go sideways immediately. I don't know what you do about that other than watch, but...
You watch. And my view, if you can spend more time on the prevention effort, and do it correctly, you will get bored watching because there won't be a whole.
Well, the watching ought to be automated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's the recognition of saying, all right, this is the benefit of doing this activity. Prevention. This is the benefit of focusing on detection. This is the benefit of response.
Mm-hmm.
But it's taking a look at saying, where am I going to get the best overall reward for the effort that I'm spending?
Sure. Yep. And I think everyone, well, hopefully the world is coming around to recognize that that early kind of investment in proactive stuff is good and that we need to do more of that.
Not that Sigital needs a plug, but I was at a conference a few months back, and it was co-sponsored by a couple of government agencies and a couple of big four security companies, and it was audience primarily a financial sector, in the very top of financial sector. And they were trying to talk, and, they sort of had these little things where you go vote with.
Mm-hmm.
And the two top concerns, and I think they're pretty close, but the top concerns that these senior security executives had in financial services, the first one was weakness in applications.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and the second, that was really close, was finding and retaining talent.
Yep. And that's very interesting that those were so closely ranked, too. But I'm not surprised. I think that's good. I don't see that in all verticals. I see more evidence of that in the financials and the ISVs when it comes to mm-hmm. software security. What other verticals do you think are emerging players in the information security space?
Certainly health sector.
Healthcare, yeah. I think that's a good one.
I was fortunate enough to spend a year and a half there, and there's a clear recognition that if you're doing something wrong, you are significantly impacting patient safety,
mm-hmm.
and that's viewed more of a risk than impacting patient privacy.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. We had a discussion about that when I was talking to the NIST guys who wanted to talk about patient data protection, and it was like, look, you got to protect the life of the patient first. Let's worry about mm-hmm. their data after they're still alive.
Exactly right. Was that also interesting? And in financial services, we always looked at the CIA confidentiality, integrity, and availability,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and those were our primary concerns. Flipped in health sector.
Oh, that's interesting.
It was availability, integrity, then confidentiality.
Yeah, so you have break the glass situations too, where you just don't have time to authenticate a doctor because someone's in a code blue situation and you got to go.
And that technology better be available.
Yep, yep.
I don't have time to worry about password. Someone is dying. Fix them.
So healthcare is an obvious one. I know you were one of the founders of the FSISAC, the Financial Services Information Sharing and Assurance Center. Can you explain the role that that organization plays and kind of what's happening in the healthcare space along those same lines?
The FSISAC was an outgrowth of a presidential decision directive in 1997, 1998 to put together an organization that would go across the sector where information security issues, concerns, threats, vulnerabilities, and incidents could be shared across the sector. There was a recognition that if it's going to happen to one financial services firm, it could happen to all.
Right. So sharing is good.
So the sharing is good. There's some issue about, concern about sharing with the government, but Treasury helped drive this when the ISAC got started.
Mm-hmm.
The Secretary of the Treasury at the time was Robert Rubin.
Yep.
He keynoted the first two organizational meetings, so the Treasury took it very seriously. It went from half a dozen, maybe 12 banks, mostly in New York on the East Coast, in 1999 to about, golly, they have 4,000 to 5,000 members now.
Yeah, it's amazing,
global,
isn't it?
And global, and it's taking off beyond anyone's belief, and the information sharing capabilities are a legend at this point.
Yeah, and so what's the healthcare situation along those lines?
They have one of the members of the board of the FSISAC has his feet in both camps. So he's now a member of the National Health ISAC,
uh-huh.
A member of the board of the National Health ISAC. And he is driving the National Health ISAC with the goal of making it as effective as the Financial Services ISAC.
I think he's going to be sitting in my house tomorrow night. We're talking about Mr. Routh, of course.
We are definitely talking about Mr. Routh, and Tosin with for me is he is one of the best CISOs out there.
Yeah, I agree.
And will turn the NHISAC into something that will be equally as accomplished and equally as successful as the financial services ISAC.
So nascent, but the drive is there and the target is there.
Mm-hmm. And so, he knows what he has. To be successful, you need to have some sense of what you mean by success.
Right.
Jim has been with the financial services ISAC for at least 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
He knows what success is. He knows what his target is. And he's driving towards that.
Yeah, so I want to ask you about that. You've been an important mentor for a whole crop of current and up-and-coming CISOs, Jim included. What is the most important lesson that your mentees had to learn that you had to sort of go out of your way to teach them or that they were the most receptive to or something like that?
First lesson I had to learn is you almost have to make a choice. Do you want to be the security technology guy or do you want to be the security executive?
Right.
And that is a choice that, I've said, think about it. It's not an easy one. Your safety, in many cases, the safety net is technology.
Right.
I said, but if you want to make that transition, you're going to go from a technological expert to being technologically proficient, to being technologically knowledgeable.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to be knowledgeable, and you need to stay on top of it. And then you have to build the communications, negotiations, and compromising skills and motivation skills to be the executive, security executive within the company.
Mm-hmm.
And until you see yourself at that executive level, you will not be at that level.
Right. You don't. No one appoints you that, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that's true, at almost every stage of the game when you're moving up the food chain,
And just have enough confidence in yourself to get out there and meet with the business executives and be confident enough so that if you're in the elevator with the CEO, number one, he knows who you are and he knows what you do,
mm-hmm.
and have something in your hip pocket to talk to him about.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, I think you used an example of the CFO in the elevator always has a line or two about the state of the company's financial health, and that's the same thing that the CSO needs.
Absolutely. And there are some really, great examples of people doing that, Jim Routh being one of them, and it is incredibly important that the CSOs begin to see themselves as in a role that is as important in transmitting information and protecting the company as other executives within the company.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been fantastic. I have one sort of crazy flyer question from left field to pose as the last one.
Okay.
And that is, what's your favorite piece of recent fiction?
I really don't read fiction.
Okay, you can change the question if you want.
I'm in the middle now of a book by Dr. Eric Topol.
Uh-huh.
Called The Patient Will See You. And he's shifting the paradigm of doctor-patient relationship.
Right.
He is known as the gadget doctor, the technology doctor, and some brilliant, he has some brilliant YouTubes out there.
Uh-huh.
His last book is The Creative Destruction of Medicine.
And you like his stuff.
Next follow-up. Yeah.
Great.
He's bringing technology to medicine and shifting the paradigm so that the patient is more responsible for care and it's much more of a collaborative environment. So I'm in the middle of that one now. The one before that was Isaacson's book on geeks and something else that changed the world.
That's right. You and I talked about that one last month, I remember. I still have to get that one. We'll get some links up to those things. But thank you very much for your time today. It's been a fascinating conversation.
My pleasure, Gary.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Cert Security. The November-December 2014 issue of IEEE S&P Magazine is a special issue on energy control system security. The issue also features coverage of the IEEE Center for Secure Design and our conversation with the founders of the CSD. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.